The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
And he said to me, be sexy. So I was sexy, and I was sexy and awesome and fantastic. And he said, be fabulous. And I said, I'll be fabulous, darling. Oh, and I said, please be on my radio. And he said, yes, yes, I'll be on your radio. And I said, oh, I bet you say that to all the girls. Frank is on right now.
We interrupt this program for no reason. Had there been a reason, you'd have been asked to go along with it and perhaps even take off your pants. But there is no reason, so now we return you to the program.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Capello.
Book to Film Adaptations, a digital story. What are we missing? In today's world, everything comes to us in an instant. Our food, our medicine, our ever-growing and changing technology. And perhaps one of the biggest commodities, entertainment. But what about our books? Are books considered instant gratification? What about film adaptations? What are we missing when we receive these books so instantly through film? There are so many movie adaptations of our favorite books. But are we missing anything in the middle? Are we creating a culture in which instant gratification is more important than the journey we take as readers? Authors sacrifice great amounts of personal time to create stories and characters. Are we selling them short by not sacrificing our own time, going through the book chapter by chapter as intended? On the flip side, film offers a different and sometimes necessary perspective of a given text. Many books would have never been read if it weren't for the interest and following sparked by the film. How many movies have you watched and heard it was a book and thought to yourself, wow, I had no idea? Film adaptations range from children's books to classical literature to current day bestsellers. The list goes on and on. Provides the viewer with an intensely visual experience, while the book is a more personal, gradual journey through character development and imagination. Are we missing something if we choose one over the other? You decide.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Capello.
Look out, because here it comes. I thought I saw it coming. I just had this ringing in my ears that said, here it comes. I know I hear it. I know it's on the way. Here it comes. And I'm telling you, in this event, in that event, and in all events, certainly in this event, What is it? I think it's this way. In that case, in this case, and in every case, coming up, probably one of the more serious things I ever did in my life. Without my pants. So come on! Everyone! You will be there, and we will be there with you when you are there. What is it?
Cthulhu Chronicles.
Trail. This is a place where you replenish your precious bodily fluids, or else you die. Yes, this show too is based upon a nightmare a nightmare once had by Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche is peachy, and so it is that Y2K plus 14 on October the 9th is Cthulhu Chronicles with philosophical entertainment, relevant irreverence, Naturati, couple surfers, netaholics, and infomaniacs. Come on in! Wake up, it's night!
球到冰球，小村到大市，咸湿屋仔到咸湿中心，系《Cthulhu Chronicles》。
From Ice Cap to Ice Cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello, and into every bordello, 'tis I, the Bard of Broadcasting, once again coming to you. Really putting my hand to my ear. Coming to you. From the studios high above the top of the, high atop hotel in downtown Burgerland. I don't know, something like that. My name is Frank Cthulhu, and the man's name adorns the title of this show. I'm chronicling, it's Cthulhu Chronicles, and we are back where we started. Tis you and I on this evening, or this afternoon, if this is a rebroadcast, or this morning, as we are live, and you're listening in Baghdad. And why not? Maybe you'll, while you're loading your guns and aiming it, them, singular to plural, ice cap to ice cap, on this Canadian Thanksgiving. There must be other holidays in the world today that I have no idea are going on at this moment in other cultures. You know, we don't know a lot about that, do we? Maybe you do and I don't. Maybe you know about all these holidays that are happening around the world that I don't know about on any given day. But they're, my calendar, as then I'm trying to think, as munificent a source for holidays, does not tell me what holiday it is in, I don't know, let's pick a place. I was going to pick like three places that came to my mind don't exist anymore as those places. There's no more Bombay. Am I correct? Isn't there another name for that? Bombay? There's no more Bombay. There's no more Constantinople. Why would that come to my mind? Istanbul. There is Istanbul because Istanbul was Constantinople. Do you remember that song? Because I used to love it. I forget what play that song, where that song originated. I'm tempted to look it up, but I'm tempted to do a lot of things, and I don't do them at the moment, because that's not what we're here for now. We're here on Cthulhu Chronicles to talk about adaptations. Not adapting, adapting adaptations. We're here to talk about whatever is involved with that particular theme. I also have on me, I'm on me right now, I have talk, I'm going to read from 7 different authors, some alive, some dead, who aboard the adaptation of their book into a movie. The merging of media, adapting one to the other, it's fascinating. It happens probably more than ever, I believe, this these days. And it probably happened more than you think it ever happened in days gone by. Now, how do I know all this? Because for some reason or another, I have the remarkable talent of remembering things and being able to call upon them that are things that are not necessarily important. Now, of course, philosophically, we could say, well, what is important? Okay? And we could list the priorities, and we can put in order the intensity of importance in our lives, and they would all be different. Each list would be different. So we're going to talk about that. And you know, that comes up for no particular reason, actually. And there's a lot of literature on my mind these days. And a lot of it is not because it's self-serving, but a lot of stuff going on with me, Frank Cthulhu, and literature, because I'm a writer. And I'm trying to break some ground. I'm starting to do some things that I meant to do for a long time. And because of this, I am thinking a lot about, not that I haven't always, I always have thought about plays that became movies, which is a shorter, and I've said this before, it's a shorter and more accurate adaptation from a play to a movie than is a book to a screenplay. For obvious reasons, the forms are entirely different, whereas a play is dialogue and various closed action. It's going to open up the action for a movie. So we'll be talking about all this kind of stuff. Now, why? I'll tell you why. Because as you heard, if you were listening to the collage, and a lot of people say, you know, he does 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes before he even talks and starts anything on this show related to the subject he claims he's going to cover. So we'll put it on, we'll settle down, we'll go get our beverage of choice, which is 3, because you're replenishing your precious bodily fluids. And then, you know, by the time I start talking, so you miss the collage. Lots of times the collage is painfully constructed. No, it's never. Believe me, it's never painfully constructed. It's always very simple. What you get is not sleight of hand. I am not tricking you. I'm just having you dance the steps that I dance as we go along. So I don't know. You can't say, how are you going to do next? I don't know. We know at the 30. No, not at the 30, at the hour. I was thinking of another show. At the 60, the end of the first hour, we'll give you some PSAs. We'll all take a moment to either fill up our cups or glasses or mugs. Cups, glasses, what else would there be? Vials? Who drinks out of a vial? to refill, let's say, the beverages that we have consumed over the hour and perhaps dispose of some bodily waste. Take a breath. Some of you people will go outside and have a quick smoke. It's got to be quick, cause, you know, and then we'll come back. But for the most part, this is going to be a drum solo show, as our good friend Kurt Brando, who will be on the show again. Let's talk first before I start getting into the literary stuff, which is going to be fun. And I'm also going to tell you a lot about what I'm going to do, because I want you to go out and buy stuff, as you've started to do, many of you, with the License to Skill, which I highly recommend for anybody who wants to prioritize their lives or learn to think critically, or I don't know. You know, you get what you get from it. Let's talk first about shows. Now, if you're listening to this show live and not on a rebroadcast at one of the fine stations that rebroadcast the show across the cyber networks of the internet and many over the airwaves, there still are airwaves, brick and mortar stations that are playing. Hello, everyone listening on a radio in your car, or nobody carries around radios anymore. You know, I wonder. No, I guess you can't. You can't go out and buy a transistor radio. You can't. No. Why? Why would anybody get a transistor radio? Doesn't even matter. You used to keep one around in case the electricity went out. That's the New York way to say electricity. Electricity. That way you can have battery operated. But I don't think you could even buy one. I've been to Kmart. I've been to, what's the other mart? Co-Mart? No, that's Costco, Cosmart, Kmart, Cosmo. What's the other mart? H-Mart. I forgot. And I can't, you can't see, yeah, everything's digital in the departments where they sell, you know, TVs and phones. Because your phone is your radio to carry around. So what am I saying? Oh, you might be listening on, oh, the station, the station's everywhere, playing Cthulhu Chronicles in one form or another, listening to it on one device or another through those stations, and headquartered here live every week at SRN Media Works. This is why this brings me, the SRN exclusive live thing brings me to this. Starting Monday, October 13th, which might be over. No, not starting. No, it's not starting then. It's going to, Tom, if you listen to this show regularly, you know about Tom Savino, my former partner in many writing projects, many music projects, many radio projects, way back when there was radio. And not, I know there's radio, but you know what I mean. When things were different, when knighthood was in flower, he is going to have an exclusive live show called Savino Veritas, which will follow this show, Cthulhu Chronicles, starting sometime soon. But on Monday, the 13th of October, if you're listening live now, and if you're not, you missed it, but you can listen to it when it starts again, or if they play it again. Live, it will be live at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Monday, October 13th. There's a regular means of connecting to SRN1, and you'll listen to the pilot show. Yeah, a pilot show. You see that? You know why? Because it was Cthulhu Savino when they were partners. My name was first. So in order to say Savino, and that was just because it sounded better. That's how we did it. We didn't do it because of anything. Savino Cthulhu did not sound as well as Cthulhu Savino. See? Cthulhu Savino. Cthulhu Savino. There's the pump. He's a pump. Pump him. He's a pump. Yes, the water pump. There's nothing I could do about, and it's been, you know, it's been a staple background sound of this show since this show began. And not just began on SRN, which was 10 years ago, but before that, when we were on ampcast.com. So when you hear it, then it goes, and then it goes off. It's got to go. It's got to happen. There's no way. I can't turn off the water pump, my friends. So we just do it. Here, high atop, the high atop hotel. There goes my voice. I wonder why that happens. Oh, it's a mucus. Yeah, mucus from the old. This is my coffee. It is indeed black as hell, strong as death. And this is not sweet as love because I didn't have any sugar. The 13th, I did mention that, and I'm going to mention it again. The pilot, Monday, October 13th, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Listen in, and you'll get a taste of what's going to happen every week after my show. For 90 minutes after my show, You're going to hear Tom Savino do his show solo. I'm not going to bug in on him like I am when I have. Well, maybe once in a while I'll be on the show for some reason or another, but I'm not going to do that. It's a solo show. It's a great show. Tom has been away from broadcasting for far too long. And there's going to be, he's not like this. This is a free for all. You know, let's say that this Cotolo Chronicles is a racquetball game compared to Tom Savino's Savino Veritas, which is like a tennis match. Strict rules. I mean, you know, he has a more controlled operation, more planned, and he's talking seriously about things and adding humor to it, as opposed to what I do. Anyway, it's different than now. Cotolo Chronicles is like a racquetball game. Now, in racquetball, you don't use one wall, right? In racquetball, you hit the ball, and as long as the first hit, and excuse me, you people who know how to play racquetball, I'm sorry for going over this, but for those of you who don't know, racquetball uses all the walls, including the ceiling, if there is a ceiling in that particular court. There I go again. That's this show. Cotolo Chronicles has always been like that. We start off with, as long as we make the serve, which is start the conversation, or start the monologue, or start the dialogue. And then from there on, wherever the ball goes, you got to hit it. And that's what happens in racquetball. That's this show. It's out of control in a certain sense. And it's, you know, randomly put together into some kind of construct. But Savino Veritas, in Wine and Truth, in case you people are starting to look that up, go to your browsers and your Veritas. What's he talking about? Savino Veritas? What was that, a cooking show? Savino Veritas. High class. Anyway, listen, let's jam the servers Monday night and get a good taste of what's going to happen when Tom is on his own show following the show. Okay, now we move on with other things that we want to talk about, and that is License to Skill at Amazon. We want to do that? We'll do now that commercial will be on in the hour when we break. Thank you all for swarming to Amazon. I still think we're number 3,432 million. You know, they actually, why did they even put those things in order? I mean, really, there's like all those books. Isn't it enough to have like I'll buy a top 100, okay? But they have on Amazon for the books, you know, the top, you know, 345 mil, the top 3 million, you know? It's like, well, who cares? Hey, I was 1,432 last week. I'm 1,400 this week. I went up 32 notches. Yeah, well, don't hold your breath. Well, in any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, what I'm saying is License to Skill has been selling. It's only digital, and it's great for your mobile device. It's 497 pages. That should not intimidate you, because I have had people tell me, even before it was released, because remember, it was a book, and it was not really released book. It was just kind of going from hand to foot and foot to mouth. It was like a disease. And people who were reading it, and then, of course, it turned into a screenplay, oddly enough, which has been trying to be, which is still in circulation, let's say, and was adapted. So that fits into what we're talking about, too. But thank you. Go read the prose. This is funny stuff. And it's funny stuff based on real stuff. It's the kind of junk that I do all the time. Now, there's also two other books that will be coming out as soon as they are modeled. I'm sorry. I just did the Spanish Inquisition bit. There are three books. I should have mentioned it. Remember the Spanish Inquisition? Monty Python? There are three books that will be published and on Amazon, although I don't know about one of them being on Amazon. At blurb.com, of course, you can get Molotov Memoirs, the original, me and, should be, T. Stefan Gesick and I. T. Stefan Gesick and I have reteamed for more Molotov Memoirs, otherwise known as 3M. That's going to be coming soon. Might still be on Blurb, but it will be digital. And that means, and you know, if you have an iPod, if you have a bigger phone or an iPad or one of those tablets, you can, it can be larger than a phone. Of course, a phone has that limited space. So it's a phone, I mean. And there are bigger phones, aren't there? Than the regular, is there a standard size phone? So we got more Molotov Memoirs. Now, the other two differ in a sense that that they're serious. They're not humorous stuff. Hey, what's going on with me? They're not humorous books? What the hell? One which has been written for a long time, and I've been promising I was going to publish, but have not, a novella. Ooh, that does not mean it's in Spanish. Said some people. That's what my father would have said. He said, are you reading that fiction book? Yeah, it's a novella. Oh, you're reading Spanish. No, novella is a short novel. It could be a short novel. It's not a novel. It's just a novel. Why, novels have sizes? Yes. Yes, novels have sizes. You're kidding. Yes, I'm kidding. It's a joke. It's the size of a book joke, Dad, which you never heard in school. Anyway, in any event, in all event, and certainly in this event, the novella titled Sweet Shepherd. I say no more. I can say no more. Say no more. Even though I'm joking about it, this is a serious novella. Simple. What's that thing? Simple and, that's a commercial. I heard it. Simple and delicious. It's simple and delicious because it's Sweet Shepherd. And a book of poetry from many, many, many. What is wrong? What is going on with this? Hey, hold on. Let me drink some. Okay. A book of poems. Actually, I believe what I've done is I went back in time and collected from many years love poems. And I'm not talking about, and this is not Hallmark stuff, okay? Jeez. The sky is blue and I love you. These are poems based on classical forms. And now that makes it sound too nice. See, now I sound like, look, it's like, it's modern poetry, all right? Based on classic poetry. How about that? How about them apples? The catchy title, as of now, is Wordsworth Shelley. Wordsworth Shelley. I'm going to tell you. You figure it out. That book of poetry by me, Frank Atolo. Anyway, I don't know what you do with it. You get it. It's not going to be expensive. You get them all. Just like, you know, you can still go to lulu.com and you can get Skull and Roses, collection of essays. Funny, funny stuff. You could get The Return of Turk Bahrain. You can't get the book called Turk Bahrain because there is none. It's just Turk Bahrain. It's just The Return of Turk Bahrain. And you could get Moon Over Gorgon. These are three books that have wonderfully funny things in them. You could even download them. Or you can get, you know what? Those are available in digital also. Everything is available in digital. But the new ones, so that means, this is what it means. It means that the people who are going to now, turned on by License to Skill, are going there and going, hey, look at all the, look, hey, I like this. So let's say they buy it. And they go, that's funny. This is funny. Guys got funny stuff. Ooh, got more funny stuff. So they go looking in Amazon for, that's why I'm telling you, this is spread out and it probably shouldn't be. But if they went to search engines, as you can go anyway, you'd find the other books at Lulu. And Blurb. So it's not like you can't find them, but we're going to try to centralize it so you can get everything when you put in the name and you go, or there's a link there that says other products or other books or other items by this author. You know, my ears should not be sweating in my headphones in the freaking middle of October. Almost the middle of October. We should open a window or something. Yeah, that's a good idea. Now, hold on, listen, wait. No, don't go away. I'll do this. I'll just open the window. I'm not going to put the fan on because the temperature is going to be dropping. I just don't like sweating like this in October. Shouldn't be happening. Well, put it, get some air in here, Frank. Okay, all right. Taken care of now. The Bard of Broadcasting has taken care of it. Anyway, that's all the stuff about the books. All this stuff's going to go on, and I'm going to tell you about it. And thank goodness you're finally going to go out and buy this stuff. And it's good. It doesn't do me. You know, I mean, I'm not going to get any Nobel. It's not Nobel Prize. What the heck is the name of that award? I don't think it's a Pulitzer. Maybe it's a Pulitzer. I got to look that up later. I still haven't looked it up. I'm not going to get rich off this stuff. And Lord knows that might not turn into movies or what have you, or TVs, or I don't know, whatever. But you will enjoy them. The written word is magic. If there is any magic in this world, I say music and the written word. And when you put the written word to music, you get a song. That's the combination. And what a successful one it's been over the decades and over the eons. My name is Frank Cotola. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of the show. I am the Bard of Broadcasting. And I'm here on Cotola Chronicles for you and for you alone. Now I'm going to talk about adaptations. Let's look at books. How many times? Let's try to start from the beginning. What is going on with that? Okay. It's a little congestion there. I don't think it's the season. Well, it's been a while since I've done a drum solo show. Even though I talk the most, even when I have guests and such. You know what else I have to tell you? I'm not done. Just coming up in the future weeks. Dr. Woldar will be back. We're waiting for Dr. Woldar. You know, he's up there. He's a really busy physicist, mathematician, scientist guy. And up there in that university, man, you know, they go to the doc Woldar. He's going to be on the show. We're going to talk about space and all sorts of other places. And I do also want to remind you to get over to forkculture.com. How could I forget my fork? You know what I need to do? I need those people to get me some MPEGs recorded for culture. There are no recorded. Just go to forkculture.com. I'm in every issue, and there's plenty of other stuff in every issue too, which you can read, and that's cutting edge also. And you read it where? Where do you read it? Those you don't send away. You can't send away. You could print them out if you want, I think. I think you could hit print, and you can get them, but that turns out to be more expensive than buying a magazine because color and the print and the paper. So you just download it, and there's no mess, no muss, no fuss, no fingertips filled with that chemical stuff. Forkculture.com. But what? That's it. Okay, that's Forkulture. And Dr. Woldar is coming. I told you about Savino. So I'll make sure I got stuff on the list here. Okay, so that's that. Writing, how many times have you read a book? In fact, let's go back to, I don't even know how far back to go. Because I don't know how far back you could go. Because we're not the same age. So, you know, if I'm older than you, I could go back farther than you. Doesn't that make sense? Right. That's the obvious. But think about the first time you saw a movie. And not the first time you saw a movie. Not the first movie you ever saw. The first time you saw a movie and either read on the screen or someone told you or you read about it. You knew that it was first a book. Now, we can go back to the beginning of movies. We can't go back to the beginning of books because we don't know when this stuff started. That's really going back and through many languages and the history of mankind. Today, I heard on the news that they found some drawings. They dated. They finally were able to date some drawings of a hand and a couple of hands that were on a cave wall. And they think that the earliest drawings, the earliest art, because that's what they did. They wrote on walls. They lived in caves. They wrote on walls. They drew on walls. I don't know what they drew. I know what they drew. I don't know what they were hands. But they say, it's about 40,000 years. 40,000 years. People were passing the time and said, thought to themselves, they figured out that something could make a mark and then they tried to copy their hand on it. You know, that would be funny if the hand, if those hand marks, those hand drawings, if they were outlines, if the person just put his hand against the wall. Have you ever, you've done that, right? A million times with a pen or a pencil. You know, you go in and out of your, and you make with the pen in one finger out the other and all around and on the piece of paper. And you make the, wouldn't it be funny if that's what they did? It wasn't even a painting. That's not art. They used to tell me, I remember when I used to draw something particularly fine. I drew something as a kid, you know, and the first thing people would say was this. What'd you trace that? Trace. Because remember, in the old days, if you had paper that was light enough and you put it over a picture, you could trace the picture. You just follow the lines of the picture. What an insulting thing. Here I drew something, and I'm so proud of it. And the first thing they do is deny that it was drawn by me. They say, what'd you do? Trace that. Now, you could take it as a compliment. Geez, that's so good. They thought I traced it, but that's not the way you take it. You go and show this. Yeah. But then they'd argue. Some of them would argue. You traced that. Because here are those voices again that I hear all the time. This is some psychological element of my life and brain and being. That the voices I hear when I imitate these voices that I remember telling me things, teachers, relatives, even my parents, it's that voice. Because those are the voices I hear. I heard the ones that stood out the most when I was a kid. Now, if I grew up in Alabama, I'd probably go, people used to say, well, what are you doing there? You know, but I didn't. I grew up in New York, and that's, you know, that's a terrible, terrible thing to admit. And as its benefits in certain ways. But my point I'm making here is that you always hear those voices. They'd argue. Arguing was one of the great elements of conversation. In New York, conversation, discussion, always included argument. So if you have a discussion about something, you would find a way, they would find a way. I didn't do this. See, I don't know, man. I was like, I don't know how. I grew up there. I took things. I left. My point being, I didn't belong there from the moment I was born. Something was wrong. And as I grew up, argument is part of discussion and conversation. Now, argument can come up in conversation in any a culture, no matter where you grew up, can happen. But in conversation, argument because people argue, what did they argue? They argued the validity of certain things, and the philosophy of certain things, they didn't look at it intellectually. For them, it was right and wrong, period. Black and white. So they would argue in a conversation, let's say a discussion. They have a discussion about parking their cars. And back in New York, they loved they felt entitled. If you owned a house, for some reason or another, if you owned a house, the owner was entitled to have the space in front of his house on the curb, his parking space. Now, obviously it was not. This is some form of entitlement that you're supposed to have, get, that you're supposed to be, it's some God-given, but not written down, some blue law somewhere that says, I own this house, I have a car, I don't have a driver or a garage, that space in front of my house should be where my car parks all the time, anytime I want to. But that didn't happen. Why did it happen? Because all the people on the same block in that neighborhood, either if they didn't have cars, it didn't matter. But the people, they what would they do? They parked wherever they had to, and they weren't the only people parking on the block. And some houses or apartments had like 2, 3, 4 cars. What were they going to do? But if you owned a house all by yourself, yeah, that's your spot. And this thing now, if they were having two men of middle age, and when I say middle age, I'm talking about like even younger than I am now. If they had discussions about parking cars in the neighborhood, they didn't even understand the intensity of this. There would be arguments. Because the person who owned, let's say the person who owns a house and feels entitled to that spot is having a discussion about parking cars with a person who doesn't own a house, but has a car and lives on that block. So now this discussion of where cars park and, you know, when they go home from work, I don't want to walk to my house. I'd like to just park my car, get in and go to my house, right in front of my house. I got to go park down the block, and then I have to squeeze into some spot. Because why? Because all cars are different sizes, right? So the spots they called them, parking spots. They didn't say, where's the car? I found a spot, they would say. I found a spot. You didn't have to say parking spot. You did not have to modify or put an adjective in front of what kind of spot. They knew you weren't talking about something on your lung. Oh, you're here early. I found a spot right in front of my house. No, not my house. That would be a spot. That's the entitlement spot. Let's say you go to visit someone and they say, wow, you're here early. You know, it's a lot of traffic tonight. Yeah, but I found a spot. And they knew immediately you meant parking spot. And that's the funny thing about that, too, is that the people, what does this have to do with adapting books to music? Forget it. It says people talking. Argument in discussion. I'm not going to do the whole routine because I don't know the routine. I'm just saying. My name is Frank Atolo, and the man whose name adorns the title of the show. Think back to when you saw a movie and someone said, that's a book. Did you go read the book? If you liked the movie, did you go to the library at the time you had to do things like that? Go to a structure called a library, a building with that housed books and allowed you to take them out and borrow them. If they didn't have a parking lot, you'd have to find a spot if you drove there. You know what's amazing to me about New York City is that so many public places did not have parking lots. And when I went to California, I was amazed in Los Angeles, which is a city, right? Certainly not the caliber or density of New York's 5 boroughs, but everywhere, a restaurant, there's at least the 10 spots you could park, at a restaurant, at a department store, there's spots. You don't have to, there's parking lots, I mean. You don't have to look for spots. So you went to the library. Maybe you got the book. You took out the book. Got. Why are they always telling me, don't use got. Got. I got. I got. Why has got become this curse word in speaking correctly? Am I supposed to say I acquired? I borrowed a book from the library. But to always say, I got a book from the library. And I got it, library. I got a book from the library, and it didn't take me but 5 minutes because I found a spot. You know, they could say to, they'd say they found a spot. You knew it wasn't a parking spot. And when they said they found a spot, that automatically meant it was close to where they were going. See, you didn't tell someone, I found a spot, if it was like 3 blocks away, which would be really incredible. That'd be, whoa. And don't think that you didn't have to park far from where you were. You're far from your destination in New York if you had to. So if you said you had a found a spot, that means that meant in those words, I found a spot. 4 words. I had to count them. Yeah. 4 words. I found a spot meant your car was parked close to your destination. Isn't that something? And everyone knew it. No one asked. No one said you found a spot close by. No. You don't have to say it. Oh, he found a spot. He found a spot. Oh, I'm parked all the way down near the deli. Another guy goes, really? Someone, and then they said, you found a spot. Someone must have got out. Now that meant, all this because you haven't even gotten the, I said got, you have not even borrowed the book from the library. Someone must have got out. Me, that meant, this is like a dictionary. So has anyone ever, well, I don't know if they talk like that anymore, regularly. Someone must have got out means that there was probably another car was parked in that place, in that space, and recently left. And you just happened to be the car coming by at the perfect time. You parked there. Now that would be a lot of words, and it almost sounds verbose. When all I had to say was, one person says, I got a spot. Oh, really? Someone must have got out. Got out. Someone must have got out. So you get, let's just say, and let's just make this so generic it doesn't matter when. If you see a movie and then you didn't know it was, the source of that movie was a book, you go today, you don't go to the library. You go to Kindle, Amazon, you go to the place where all the books, you find out if it costs, you can't borrow it. Some are free, I think, because their copyrights have run out of, I guess you could get Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for nothing. Nobody's collecting those Robert Louis Stevenson royalty checks anymore. Where would it go? To the Stevenson house? Is there a Stevenson house? Is anyone still alive related to Robert Louis Stevenson? I ask you. Go look that up on your Google. So you go and get the book. Or do you? Or do you not? Do you say, well, I saw the movie. I don't want to say it. Why would I sit down and read the book? A lot of people used to say that way back when. Now, this can go a number of different ways. Because the people who do read books, when a book becomes popular, it becomes a commodity. It becomes a cash cow. And this is even way back when. And probably more so way back when, because publishing meant more way back when. So let's talk about a book like From Here to Eternity, way back when. And this became very, very popular, this book. People were reading the book. And Hollywood said, hey, we got to have this. Is everybody's reading the book. They want to see a movie. I think it works the other way around. A lot of people who read a book and love a book probably will never love the movie adaptation better but they will want to see it. So, and then the people who didn't read the book said, like, oh, that book's gigantic. Let's just go see the movie, you know. And what they don't understand, or they do understand and don't care about, is that there is a disparity between the sources of material that is gigantic. And the people who write the books are not always happy about how the movie turns out. Now, they might, don't ask me why they allow the movie to be made with the same title, because it's not always money. It's always money. So if you know, they come to you and they go, we want to buy the rights to this book, and the book is a massive bestseller, then usually the publishing company, I think, has, I don't think writers or authors, even back in those days, had so much clout that they could say, no, you will not make a movie of this. They're just going to ruin it. And then people won't buy the book. That didn't happen. They just, you know, the check came in the mail and they went, oh, look at this. And they talk like that too. See, there are the voices again. So this happens a whole bunch of different ways. But the adaptation done by a screenwriter, many times screenwriters have to read the book because they got to know how to adapt it. And they have to know what to cut out, and they have to know what to change because it's an entirely different medium. If you have a book, I don't care if it's a novella, as I mentioned, which is not a novel written in Spanish. In the feminine, it's a short novel. That still is way more complex. It's a whole different medium. As was said in the collage, that wonderful girl talked about adaptations. What are you missing? What's missing in the movie? Well, it's not just what's missing in the movie. It's what has been changed to fit the format. You can't do everything that is in the book. Now, if you have in those days they didn't have a movie series, a TV series. You have TV series. There was a famous book, at least a popular book. I don't know. Famous is popular, right? Yeah, that's it. Then I'm not adding quality to this particular monologue. Rich Man, Poor Man, and they made that into a television series. With that television series, they were allowed to put in more content. Here's another perfect example: Roots. Roots was a book everybody was reading. They did not make a movie out of it. They made a TV series out of it. And by making it a TV series, and I don't know how long it ran, 8, 9, 10, 10 hours, 11 hours, 12 hours, you can't make a 12-hour movie. You can, but who's going to sit through it? Okay, certainly not anymore. Movie theaters, yeah, theaters that play movies, movie theaters, are small. My saloon doors just what happened? There was just a breath of silence because they took a pause from all that information with piling through. After the 10 o'clock hour, into the second hour, for those of you who are not listening and that's not the time, for those of you who are listening and that is not the time because you're not listening live, I'm going to go talk about, I'm going to read from, I think it's 10 or 7 authors that hated and what they had to say about the movie version of the book. Drastically change. Even, now it's always better if the author of the book writes the screenplay if it's going to become a movie. Now a lot of you are saying, what the hell is this all about anyway? And who gives a rat's derriere? Well, you know, I guess in a sense it has to do with how you adapt. I get you can transfer this to your own life. You could transfer it to your own life. Transfer it? You can adapt this to your own life. There's adapt again. Do I have to take out the dictionary? The Great American Dictionary? Must I? No, I don't. And of course, there's all the movies that are made and remade from books that were never that were written before they were movies, and the authors died, so you know they don't care. They might have cared. You know, they might have cared. What would Charles Dickens have said about, you know, about the first Great Expectations movie, or the second, or the third? And they kept changing that, like they do with Shakespeare plays. They take it and they take the basic idea and the real characters of the book, and then they like make it contemporary if it was a period piece, blah blah blah. You've seen that done. Oh God, Shakespeare does that, you know, forever. They do that with Shakespeare. He didn't do it forever. He had no idea. Movies. What is that? This guy's more, you know, he's got one stage. I've seen the Globe Theater. There's not a lot of places on a stage. The original Globe Theater, there's not a lot of spaces to do things. And I was, as I watched the Mark Cousins brilliant documentary, The Story of Film, which I recommend everybody get and watch, because this is the art form of our time. So it doesn't go back beyond the late 1880s. The idea, the concept of the flashback, which could be done in books, wasn't done in plays. Shakespeare never did a flashback in his play. He would close the curtain, and some guy went, "Oh, 14 years ago!" Now that's the way all the English people speak, Frank. Is that what you're saying? I have all these, there's the pump. Pump time. I have all these wonderful listeners in our great, in the great, great Britain, Great Britain. The great, great Britain. And what do? I get this, is that Cockney? Oh, I don't know. I remember hearing people talk like that in pubs when I was there. And they do, probably still do. It's not, my point is not to mock how they, I mock everybody. I mock myself. I mock myself. I mock whoever I'm imitating. I'm sorry. I'm a mocker, not a rock. Remember the Mods and the Rockers? The Mods and the Rockers? During the 60s, there were these, the rock and roll kids. There were the Mods dressed up really well, and the Rockers who dressed up really scroungy. And they said, "Are you a mod or a rocker?" Was that one of the Beatles that said, I'm a mocker? And that was probably Ringo Starr. I'm a mocker. He's a little bit of each. My name is Frank Cotolo. I'm the man who adorns the title of this show, Cotolo Chronicles. What we're going to do is take a slight break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk more about, you know, I'm going to get you to read books. Source material. Roots themselves of, and you know, a lot of you people know a lot of these, you younger people know a lot about this in one way, because even a comic book is a source material. It's a reading, even though, you're right, graphic novels are just classy comic books. But they're written for that medium, not written so that they could be transferred to film. Plays, as I said, are different, and it's a whole different experience seeing a play than seeing a movie, but it's not that different. Because it's live, it's different because it's not that different because it usually stays within, it's dialogue, and you have to make up things when you do a movie from a book, because a book has prose, and prose has to be done visually. It's all pop culture, I guess. I don't know the original intent. Maybe I should look at, this is just fascinating to me, and I think it'd be fascinating to you. Imagine if you wrote a letter. Of course, you don't write a letter. Let's say an email. Let's say you wrote a very long email. let's bring this up to contemporary times. Although people still do write books, and they just publish them electronically. And now anybody can write books and publish them. Not that they're all good, but the material is tremendous. So much material now, because it's available to more people than used to be. Let's say you write an email and somebody comes up and says, you know, that email gave me a terrific idea for a short film. So I'm going to take your email and make it into a short film. Make an email into a short film. based on an email by T. Sorensen. Where did that name originate? I'm thinking of Ted Sorensen. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking of somebody in the Kennedy administration. Sorensen, wasn't he? Wasn't he the secretary of something? Is there a secretary of something? There's a secretary of everything. So, and then you would say to, oh, but I wrote that email. I took so much time to write that email. And then somebody else is going to take it and make it into pictures. And it's like, wow, how do you do that? Oh, that's wrong. That's not the one I said. That's not what you see what I'm saying. Then suddenly you have something to say. Well, these authors we're going to talk about had something to say. And they didn't like it one bit. So we'll be, so remember, this has a lot to do with even how you adapt your own thoughts. We'll be right back. Go fill up with something.
The Dole Chronicles, the internet talk show from the neo-postmodern world.
Dying out. A new champion emerges. Wacky escapades. Parallel universes.
Hello, everyone. This is me, Frank Cotolo.
There's never a dull moment as Frank weaves a tale of a writer making you laugh, chuckle, and learn a bit about life. Pick up License to Scale by Frank Cotolo. Now on Amazon for your Kindle.
Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise.
And all was Benjamin Franklin wise.
So you actually think electricity can pass through metal? Ha! Ben Franklin, go fly a kite.
Excellent idea. Where are my keys?
Besides the bifocals, Ben invented the Franklin
Up
stove.
You go!
The odometer. And the lightning rod! Ingenuity! Pass it on! From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com!
If you've ever spotted a barred owl, a Blanding's turtle, or a dragon's mouth orchid, then you're one of the lucky few. Because the opportunities to spot these marvels are getting fewer. The more we build, the more nature is disappearing. But you can help. Visit OntarioNature.org. The pulse of Ontario isn't in its wildlife, woodlands, and wetlands. It's in the hearts of the people who protect them. Show you care for lots of little reasons.
Would it be crazy if you just stopped everything, packed your bags and left for a week, a month, a year? What if you left for 2 years? Would people think you'd lost your mind? What if you were going far away to help in a village on the edge of the Gobi Desert? A village crowded with Buddhist temples, not skyscrapers. A place where there isn't a word for recluse, but 1,000 words for community. Would it be crazy to go 5,000 miles from home? To spend time with people the rest of the world only reads about? To build libraries and fill them with stories? Prepare a meal with food you helped grow? To teach children and learn a thing or two about yourself? Would that be crazy? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you. Yes, I'm
gonna be a star. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hello, I'm John Lithgow. Manatees are unique, among the most amazing animals on Earth, but they're endangered. We pose the greatest threat to their survival. Many manatees are killed or injured by boats or other recreational activities. I'm a writer of children's books, including one about manatees, and I believe education is the key. You can be part of the solution. Please contact Save the Manatee Club right now. Call 1-800-432-JOIN. Thank you.
I want to tell you to do one thing, though, and if you'll pay attention to me, it might save your life. I want you to buckle up and live. Seatbelts and shoulder harnesses can be your second chance. Now, if you never had an accident, you could be next, because you gamble every time you get in your car. Now, you cut down the odds against you getting killed, you understand, by buckling up your seatbelt or your harness. Use them as advised by your car's manufacturer, and have your passengers use them, too. Automobile accidents can be deadly. Be sure you get that second chance. Buckle up and live.
Everybody's voting for the friendly voice of radio, the people's choice. Music, weather, sports, and news, it's radio. The people choose. Everybody's swinging to the swinging voice of radio, the people's choice. Big fry, small fry, dawn to dawn, it's radio that turns them on. Swinging, singing, a million sounds you want to hear. It's a landslide every year. Everybody's diving in the smiling voice of radio, the people's choice. East Coast, West Coast, in between, it's radio that makes the scene.
That's right, it is radio making the scene. Listening to me, Frank Cotolo, man whose name adorns the title of the show. This is Cotolo Chronicles. I am chronicling on this Y2K plus 14. Some people might say on shows, this is our 1,433rd show. I am not keeping count. Hey, did you ever just automatically smell something? And it reminded you of someone? It just happened. Wow. These are normal things. These things happen. Not did you ever. Of course you have. Tell me you have. Of course you have. We're here till for another hour now. And I'm going to talk about. I kind of tried to bring it home by telling you, giving you that example about writing an email somebody takes and. Well, maybe, you know, or if you have written a book or written a composition, anything you've written that can become, because things are adaptable. For instance, some movies you've seen that are like real, and movies that are now classics. So like 2001, Space Odyssey. A lot of people have seen that. And you can see it again, because now with television and cable, you could see all these, they show everything they possibly can. Now, there's a movie that the author wrote based on a short story he wrote. It wasn't based on a short story. It's a big movie. He in league with... Bump. We're moving right along. It's like we're on a ship somewhere. And the engine. And he wrote a short story. I forgot his name. Believe it or not. I know Stanley Kubrick co-wrote the movie because they had a whole different vision. He's the director and he sees that he's a visual. And a writer has to be visual with words, and a director has to be visual with his camera and her camera. And so, But he read the short story. Kubrick read the short story. He said, you know, we could expand this. He said to the guy, let's make it into a movie. This is a good idea, so let's expand it. Just a short story. There is no book. Now, there used to be, and I don't know if there is this anymore, there used to be people who did novelizations. That's right. After the movie, in other words, the movie that was not taken from a book, I don't know if it was ever done. Let's just say a movie that was not taken from a book. It's an original screenplay. So it's not adapted. It's the screenplay meant to be. And that community creation with the staff and crew and director and everybody and music. But it's an original screenplay. It was not based on anything. Now, of course, everything's based on something. But let's just look at it like that. Let's say Chinatown. There's a very popular movie that was paid a lot of money for the screenplay from, I think that was Robert Townsend. Robert. Anyway, now when the movie's made, the company hires someone to novelize it. So they, and then to take the screenplay and make it into prose. I don't know if that's done anymore. It used to be a big business, and a lot of writers got a lot of work doing novelizations. So they wouldn't write it if it was already a book. People would go out and buy the original book. So, but 2001 was based on a short story. Now, The Shawshank Redemption, there's a movie. Why, there's a whole cable channel dedicated to playing that movie 24 hours a day. Isn't there one? Because it seems like the movie's always on. This is a Stephen King novella. It's a short. That's right. It's not a novel in Spanish. It's a novella. It's called The Shawshank Redemption. And what was her first name? Not Greta Garbo. I mean, I can't remember. You know, with the legs. Anyway, it was called something else. But and The Shawshank Redemption. And they just made it The Shawshank Redemption. They even edited the title. Rita Hayworth. That was it. Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption. That was the name of the novella. And they called it, and then the director took it and said, I'll just call it The Shawshank Redemption and let's change it. I don't know what Stephen King had to do about that. I know that Stephen King, speaking of Stanley Kubrick and Stephen King had nothing to do with, and there's a movie that's considered a classic, is The Shining. And here's a movie that Stephen King wrote the book, The Shining. Maybe it was called, I don't know, it might have been called Loretta Young and The Shining. Used another actress. No, it wasn't. It was, you know, but it was different. And he didn't like what Kubrick did. It's a beautiful movie to watch, but he changed a lot. It's not faithful to the novel. And that's the term used. And you can only be so faithful no matter what. Even Roots, the TV series that ran for, 12, 13, 14, 15 hours, even that was not totally faithful to the huge book. Okay? So there. It's very difficult to make that transition. But writers have a lot to say, and I'm going to look at a few very famous authors who, for one reason or another, you be the judge, hated the movie adaptations. And you know, they even made a movie about one. Imagine that. They made a movie about the one who hated. Okay, we'll get to that. We could start off with a movie called American Psycho. Now, I'm reading, quoting from a James Perez article from, by golly, it's like last week. It's this week. It's just like, okay. So there. Let me read you his little introduction. Although books are a frequent source of inspiration for filmmakers, Hollywood doesn't always see eye to eye with the authors of those books because books are for nerds. This is how he writes it, okay? Books are for nerds. So who cares what they think? He's writing this. I'm not telling. It's not me. Understandably, this often doesn't sit well with the writers, who they think are nerds. Books are for nerds? Yeah, where did that... See, that's really bad and dangerous, and it really subverts the experience of reading a book, and it's not there because the written word will always be here anyway, and certainly in the prosaic word, but anyway, okay. Understandably, this doesn't often sit well with the writers, but it doesn't mean the author is always right. In fact, some of our favorite movies or books in Hollywood, quote-unquote, ruined in the eyes of the authors. So I'm going to giving you an article here that's from someone who actually thinks the movies were better than the books. I guess this is, again, and this could come back to having the discussion which turns into an argument. Because it's an apple and an orange. The movie is the movie and the book is the book. These are different mediums. There's no way to compare them. It's like versions. You can... Plane flying. Because I opened the window, remember? Make it cool in here. Didn't make it much cooler, but the temperature is dropping. But I'm not here to do the weather. I'm not Uncle Weatherby. I'm Frank Cotolo. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of the show, and you're listening to Cotolo Chronicles. So this guy, and this guy, I didn't even realize this because, you know, I don't do a lot of research in anyway. But this is good that this fellow, younger fellow, just likes the book. Now, I guess he read the books too. I'm going to assume that as he writes. There's a book called, a movie called American Psycho. It's the perennial favorite about a psychopathic yuppie in 1980s New York who may or may not be a serial killer, depending on how you interpret the film's vague third act. It's easily Christian Bale's second most famous role after his work in Newsies. Okay? I have seen neither of these, and I have not read the book. And I don't... And Christian Bale is... All right. So I don't know. But it says here, for Bret Easton Ellis, who is the author of the book American Psycho, the movie falls short for two reasons. He is the source. He says, it's simply not ambiguous enough, and the director didn't have a penis. Now, I would imagine he's trying to say... Oh, there's more here. In Ellis's opinion, the author's opinion, his book is unfilmable because its stream of consciousness narrative can't be faithfully adapted into a visual medium. And to be fair, the book is done in the style of a rambling and incoherent revenge fantasy of the kind typically found scribbled in a notebook in a bus station locker. So even the book was written in the style of the guy, the character. It's first person, and he's just all over the place, right? Ellis thinks that the story's central ambiguity is ruined by physically seeing a naked Christian Bale chasing a prostitute down a hallway with a chainsaw, because seeing it forces the viewer to conclude that it actually happened as opposed to happening only in the character's mind. According to Ellis, the author, there's just no ambiguity or metaphor in film, period. That seems to indicate that he's never seen a David Lynch movie. And that's this guy saying, uh-huh. Now, David Lynch, this guy's got a, I don't know about David Lynch. David Lynch, incidentally, is in one of the stories in the new Molotov Memoirs book to be released sometime, I don't know, before the end of the year for Christmas. So you can buy it. It'll be had a commercial in there, too. Okay. Is that enough about American Psycho? Another problem with the movie, he says, is that it was directed by a woman. Uh-oh. When asked for his opinion about the director, who was Mary Harron, Ellis said, I think it's a medium that really is built for the male gaze and the male sensibility. I mean, the best art is made under not an indifference to, but a neutrality toward the kind of emotionalism that I think can be a trap for women directors, unquote. That's what he said. He is infamously claimed that Academy Award-winning director Catherine Bigelow has a career only because she's a very hot woman. Hey, this guy, he's not afraid to be politically incorrect, I'll tell you that much. So you got to give him credit for that, no matter what your grandmother is. Okay, you can call him this, call him that. Okay, you can't deny that the movie camera was invented by a man. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Here's one. How about the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? William Abergel, man, boy. And this is adding music to it. Man, I'm making music into making a musical from a book. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is a film that managed to endear an unapologetic child predator to generations of moviegoers. Okay. Here we go. We're going to see how things change in an adaptation. Given the paradoxically creepy nature of Roald Dahl, who is the world-famous children's author who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the novel Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, it's perhaps not that surprising that Dahl hated the movie for not being dark enough. The movie, they took it and they put it through the Hollywood filtering machine, through the story filtering, the deflavorizer. It took the flavor out of it. This happens a lot. Hollywood sees a movie that can be commercially acceptable to great audiences, large audiences, and child, family PG rated. If only they change it. And it's changed. So this guy's, Dahl was pissed because apparently Willy Wonka, Willy Wonka, and you know the old thing about, chalk, want a piece of candy, kid? Man, no, I didn't read the original one, but apparently Willy Wonka, this is like Alice in Wonderland, being an incredible political statement disguised as a child's novel. But that's Lewis Carroll, that's a whole other story. Dahl was at odds with the film from the very beginning. He had no respect for the director, Mel Stewart, insisting the man had no talent to flair whatsoever. That's what Dahl said about the director. And he hated the film's numerous, and I quote, trashy musical numbers, even though they all celebrate the ironic murder of children, which, as any fan of Dahl knows, was his favorite subject. You know, are you feeling this? Are you understanding what we're saying? This is taking, I don't know this guy, and I didn't read it, but apparently Willy Wonka was a child bonker? What? I don't know how you put it. Oh, wow. Amazing. I'm learning stuff for the first time. Dahl was particularly upset about, wait a second. Of course, the music, which is wonderful music done by Broadway and very popular original Broadway musical songwriters, Anthony Newley and Leslie Bercus, who did Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd on Broadway, and the other one, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Which is also, wait a second. Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. That could be Roald Dahl's. He might probably like that one, but he thought it was about something else. Okay, come back. Come on back here. And then I think that's great music. But of course, I'm looking at the piece now, not as the prosaic piece. Dahl, the author. And if you get a chance to look at this guy, go to Google or Yahoo. Go see his picture. He's a weird looking fella. He's a weird looking fella. He's a nefarious looking fella. I don't want to say weird because that doesn't really describe it. He's a nefarious looking fellow. And his name is Roland. It's not Roland. I think he left out it's Roald Dahl. D-A-H-L. Okay, Dahl was particularly upset about, check it out, the Oompa Loompas. The Oompa Loompas are not in the book. In the novel, in the novel, the Oompa Loompas were African pygmies working in perpetual servitude to make candy for their wealthy benefactor, Willy Wonka. He had the Oompa Loompas from Africa. This is like slavery. Don't like slavery, huh? Dahl saw no problem with this in the book, of course, but the NAACP disagreed. See, this is like, so the film transformed the Oompa Loompas into a platoon of creepy orange-skinned little people of indeterminate race. Little people. Dahl eventually agreed that changing the Oompa Loompas to avoid offending the African-American community was probably for the best, and subsequent versions of the book also reflected that change. Although he did describe the NAACP's demand as, and I quote, "real Nazi stuff," unquote. Dahl was... You know, writers and artists, you know, they're not normal per se. So to say he's crazy is to say, well, you know, who else would have come up with this thing? But as production continued, Dahl became frustrated by the producer's insistence on making Wonka the center of the story, which culminated in them changing the title of the film to focus on Willy Wonka and the chocolate bar marketing tie-in the producers had arranged. There's commercial stuff involved. They want the Wonka chocolates. They had a product involved that make more money than the movie would make, or make money on the chocolate if the movie didn't make money. Excuse me. So he hated everything about the film's portrayal of Wonka, and especially Gene Wilder. He hated Gene Wilder, who everybody, more people have seen the movie than have ever read any of these books, or this book, at least. Maybe there are more. Maybe Wonka dies at the end of the book. I don't know, the novel. But they'll always know this character he created as another character. You see why adaptations, see what they do? I see why it's important to go to the source of everything. That's what this show is about. Go to the source of everything. Don't just listen to what someone says. Don't just accept it, right? Go to the source. Here, we're right back to where I started. Okay? The doors. The saloon doors, not the doors. He hated Gene Wilder. He felt Wilder was pretentious and insufficiently gay and bouncy. Okay. Dahl was evidently not a fan of Wilder's subdued, borderline chilling characterization of Wonka, who this writer believes was, you know, great. This is better than the play, than the book. A man who owns slaves and murders children in a black magic house of candy. Hey, imagine pitching that to the studios. I got a great idea. I have a great idea, man. This guy was the guy had to change from this New York guy to this L.A. hip guy, old guy. Now, hell, L.A. guy, hip guy. I don't even know how to categorize him. And that's how he talked, right? Like, you know, he's Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now, talking like that, man. And he says, imagine this. He goes to Paramount, and he goes, I get a great idea for a movie, man. It's a man who owns slaves and murders children in a black magic house of candy, man. Candyman, the Candyman can. That's right, the Candyman can. You imagine Dahl probably just, and that became a hit. That became like a major top 10 hit, the Candyman, for Sammy Davis Jr. And that comes from the movie. Who could take tomorrow, stick it in your nose, you make it in a bar, and then you get jelly beans, the Candyman. Despite collecting. Now, here's this. He got, listen to this. This is despite the fact that he cashed a check given to him by the studio for $300,000. That's what he made for not doing a thing, just giving the book over. He ultimately disowned the film and actively campaigned against it in several magazine and TV interviews. Even after the movie's success boosted his book sales, and imagine how disappointed the readers of those books. So, you know, ruined it for him. He still claimed the whole experience had left him enormously depressed. So it is arguably for the best that he didn't live to see Tim Burton's version. and there's a movie. I don't even know why they made that again. Why did they make that? talking about children's film, let's go on to this one now. He talks about Charlotte's Web. There's a movie called Charlotte's Web, the 1973 animated Hanna-Barbera classic. Charlotte's Web has gone down in history as one of the greatest non-Disney cartoons ever made, despite facing stiff competition from Fern Gully and Cats Don't Dance. I don't know any of those, but obviously they're movies that equate to being competitive with Charlotte's Web. However, while Charlotte's Web has managed to endear itself to parents and lazy daycare center employees for decades, it did not sufficiently charm author E.B. White, who considered the whole thing a nightmare that he'd prefer to forget. Now, I'm going to stop for one second here and give you a personal experience. If I am not mistaken, E.B. White is also, and I'm going to look this one up right now, because I'm going to look this one. I'm going to go to my Google because I did not expect this to pop up, that I have a personal experience of adaptation that I'm going to share with you through this. Here's Google right here. I think if I'm going to put this in here and find this out right now, discover this right now, and then give you that information from the source, me, a man who adapted. What did I just say? Oh, okay. Let's see if I'm correct. I could actually tell you this anyway. I just want to make sure it's him. I'm pretty sure it's E.B. White that we're going to be talking about. E.B. White. Did he not do? Didn't he do? Yes. Yeah, E.B. White. Hold on, let me do this here for one second, and I'll tell you here. And this was also, where is he? Who? Didn't he write this? I'm positive. I don't know why I'm having a problem with this, but I'm pretty sure it's E.B. White. I believe, what? Look, search, come on, go. Come on, your Google, go. Oh, this is it? It already went and I didn't know. Why doesn't he show up here? Okay, here, let's just look at the Charlotte's Web. Why does it go to Facebook? Why don't I just go to, why don't I go to Amazon. Here I have all this all talk about Amazon. And let's see. This is the way to go. What I'm trying to do is establish the fact that E.B. White from Charlotte's Web. Oh, White. Oh, come on. Why doesn't... you know what it is? Why is it taking... E.B. White books. Here. Why is it taking so long to do that? Here's New York on E.B. White. Did he write? He wrote Stuart Little. We know about that. Someone is emailing me the answer. Is that what's going on? Where is it? Didn't he do this? Someone wrote to me. I know. No, absolutely wrong. nobody wrote it. I could have sworn it. It's E.B. White. Let's wait. Let's go to page two. E.B. White, E.B. White, E.B. White, E.B. White. Some Pig by E.B. White. Okay. Did he write? No. Why is he there on writing? Well, no. E.B. White. I can't be wrong. I know I believe this wrong. Why don't I just look for the book instead of looking for him, right? Is that what I'm going to do? Okay. Well, you know what? I don't even have to look. Oh, that was A.A. Milne. See, I was wrong. Okay. But I'll tell you about A.A. Milne, who created Winnie the Pooh. Okay, I do have a... It's not E.B. White. So I'm gonna... Since we... For the sake of time, I'm not going to tell you about Charlotte's Web. I'll tell you about A.A. Milne. A.A. Milne is the author of... and the creator of Winnie the Pooh. Everybody knows Winnie the Pooh. I'm not going to tell you about A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh being adapted into the... I don't know. Was it a movie? No, it was a movie. It was a TV series. I have no idea because I never watched it. I was too young. Too old. I wasn't too young. But A.A. Milne also wrote a number of other things, including a play called... Are you going to actually not remember this, Frank? The something princess. The princess queen. No, the... He wrote a play called The Ugly Duckling. Now, that's not The Ugly Duckling. He took the... not The Ugly Duckling from the fairy tale. Okay, he just took that title from The Ugly Duckling. Let's just say... The Ugly... And it's not... Of course, there was that famous song... Because that was a who? Who did that? What fairy tale guy did that? There once was an ugly duck. Hans Christian Andersen. Okay, this, you see how this gets incredibly complex when it's simple? Hey, let's do this. A.A. Milne, forget about Winnie the Pooh and all this other stuff. A.A. Milne created Winnie the Pooh. He also wrote a children's book called The Ugly Duckling. It's about a princess who's so hideous that nobody wants to go out with her. Or they think she's hideous, or she's beautiful, but something or other. But here's the point I'm trying to make. The point is that my musical writing partner, when it wasn't Tom Savino, was another man named James Chiquitas. Because you know why? Because you could go to YouTube and you could actually hear some songs done by other groups that were written by he and I. There was in New York, there was an off-Broadway presentation going to be produced of The Ugly Duckling. A.A. Milne's The Ugly Duckling. Someone had made it into a play with the permission of A.A. Milne. Okay? So they had the permission for that. They came to Mr. Chiquitas and I, the producers of this play, and they said, well, we'd like to make this a musical. Really? So read the play and come up with the songs for it. And then we will add them and then work around the... blocking and whatever, doing the play. And then we're going to add your songs, those songs that will complement this, The Ugly Duckling, and make it into a musical. And this is not a very complicated, sophisticated thing. Like, you know, be a guy on piano, and it's going to be a very music hall type musical. So we're going to write these songs. Mr. Chiquitas and I are going to write these songs, and we're going to present it to them, and then they're going to put them in various parts of The Ugly Duckling, so that The Ugly Duckling by A.A. Milne also features songs, original songs by Cotolo and Chiquitas. Okay? All right. So we got the job. The job paid money. It was a pay money job. We were Broadway. It's off-Broadway, but... And I'm giving off-Broadway. You know, there's Broadway, off-Broadway, and off-off-Broadway, and everybody does it, and there's all sorts of stuff. But we get paid to do this, and we want to do this, because this is, at the time, while we were doing songwriting, mostly, and publishing our own stuff, we said, this is a great thing to do. And we like plays, we liked all sorts of music. We weren't just, you know, rock and roller type guys. We studied all sorts of music, and anyway... We came up with a bunch of songs for this play, which was not a very long play, but now it was longer because it had music, had songs. It did not have a pump. That pump is, well, it's loud for me because my monitor's on loud, but you can hear it. And I don't care either way. If you want that, you know, go listen to those talk show guys on radio if you want to hear that kind of stuff. I mean, you don't want pumps and static and pops from the pops. Anyway, let's go back to this. Okay, so here's what happened. I thought we really came up with some great songs. We came up with some great songs, and they were placed perfectly because we had studied Broadway musicals, and we knew, we just had a feel for where songs appear, what parts of plays were good for songs, of adapting this. We're adapting this into a... So now the expressions that characters are going to make from the text written or approved. I don't know who wrote it. I get, unless A.A. Milne wrote it, too. Yeah, he wrote the play from his stories. He wrote it. Now we're going to express certain aspects of the story in songs written by Catolo Chiquitas. So, we present these songs to the director. Producers don't mean nothing in play. Producers are pretty, they just come, you know, money and stuff. The directors are the true, and in movies too, for that. And they love it. They love them. And they should. They were very good. And someday we'll talk about them and I'll play the demos. I won't, they're horrible. No, but demos are okay. But I mean, they're just, that in those days you didn't record things the way you record them today. Anyway, we now have adapted A.A. Milne's The Ugly Duckling into a musical. The director and the people involved in the play never thought to contact the estate of A.A. Milne. Mr. Milne, I believe is a man, A.A. Milne, is dead. He was dead back then. This is like the 70s. He was dead then. But he had an estate. And the play was published by, you know, when you, anyway, they had the rights to the play to stage it. See, there's another, I found a spot. Someone must have got out. Did he do it? He produced a play. He did it? He do it? Did he have permission to do it? They performed and presented it. Well, word got back very quickly to the Milne estate that Mr. Milne's, I'm going to assume it's a man, it doesn't matter, was that Milne's material has now been altered. Mr. Milne's material in the form of the play called The Ugly Duckling now shares credits with songwriters who express certain elements of his play in song. Well, did there was trouble there? And these are not the first people who wanted to sue Catolo Chiquitas. And for, let me tell you something, you know, this is just copyright stuff. I don't know. And ego and what have you. We steal anything per se. But the play, the music, the directors should have realized they just, I mean, what? They thought they could just do this? Did they have no sense of business? Was there not someone who said, you know, I don't think you could do that without permission of the author or what have you? But they didn't like the estate of A.A. Milne. Was aghast. And believe it or not, and I know you'll believe it because I'm telling you, we adapted this. Now, let me tell you, there's two sides of this. Number one, of course, the play was taken off. The music was, I mean, was, I think it was on twice or three times, then it got back to them. They had to take the music out if they were going to use the material. So we didn't lose the publishing and stuff, but nobody ever really did the songs, but except they were in that context. But we couldn't, you know, I mean, somebody else could have done the play with those songs. Those songs could have become a part of the play. And we got shuffled right out of the whole deal. But we read the play, we watched, we adapted it with the sense, and the Milne people, and this has to do with what we're saying about the authors. The Milne estate never even listened to the songs. They never even wanted to imagine that these songs brought a new dimension to the work, that it would have meant the work would be produced more and in different ways. And all they had to do was share, and they never even asked to share. They didn't say, listen, we'll do this, but we get 50% of the songs. Nothing. They just said, that's it. No, you do not do it. It was like across the line. And they didn't give us a chance to show them how well it was done. It was really done well. I know it was done well, and I know that the play was appreciated. I heard people applaud when they did it. I heard people enjoy it, and the people who were in it, the actors, were wonderful interpreting these songs. They weren't made for me to sing or for Mr. Chiquita to sing. Right? I mean, they could do whatever they want. It was made for that particular thing. It was crafted and adapted for that. But we got the boot, and that was the end of that. The Ugly Duckling never played with those songs in the play again. But it was one of two. But that was my theatrical experience with adapting. I have other experience with adapting things, but they never went to stage. That went to the stage. That went to production. That went to an audience. And it was a shame. So, Charlotte's Web. So you can see that. So, and authors, and we did not subvert the energy, feel, meaning, or integrity of that play with those songs. And they didn't even give it the chance. I'm going to pass by Charlotte's Web. Who didn't like Charlotte's Web? The person who wrote it? Oh, yeah, right. Who is the person who wrote it? T.B. White. Who is it? I forgot what I was even talking about. I got to A.A. Milne from E.B. White. It's those letters. Why didn't somebody tell me he had those letters? E.B. White didn't like it. He said he considered the whole thing a nightmare, and he'd prefer to forget Charlotte's Web. When Hanna-Barbera purchased the film rights to the novel, the only demands White made were that he should have final approval on the design of Charlotte the Spider, and that the film should under no circumstances be turned into a musical. Listen to this. I didn't even realize that was going to be the case, and I told the story from my personal experience. That fit like a glove. Where did that come from? Shakespeare? Fits like a glove. Either that or it came from the trial of... No, it was well before Otis Redding. It's not Otis Redding. It's not Otis Redding. It wasn't him. The pump is... Why is that pump going on every 5 minutes? That's the question. Okay, so he said he hated it. Okay, he hated that. Let's move on because we're running out of time. How about this book called The Neverending Stories? One of those movies that defined your childhood. Not mine, maybe yours. I have no idea because I never read this. Oh, unless you were born after the 80s. What do you mean after the 80s? I was born way 30 years before the 80s. And I did knew nothing about it. You just refused to watch the classics that were treasured by previous generations. That? Okay, now I'm getting editorial. Anyway, somewhere out there, they said, listen to this. The writer says, somewhere out there is a rare kid who saw the movie and just hated it. Maybe even for reasons other than the gratuitous horse drowning scene. I don't know about it. I didn't see it. I don't hate it. I don't like it. I don't care about it. But that's, so I'm one of those people. And if so, then you have something in common with Michael Ende, the author of the novel on which the movie is based. You see, Ende despised the Neverending Story movie so much that he fought until his dying day to destroy it. That's an alliteration. At first, he was in favor of the movie adaptation and defended the venture to skeptical fans of the novel. But then Ende had already written the screenplay with director Wolfgang Petersen, so he felt pretty confident that the movie would be faithful to his original story. That is, until the revised screenplay made its way to his desk. The producers of the film had hired another writer to punch up Ende's script without telling him. Here we go. Because they'd already paid for the film rights to his novel and, quite honestly, didn't give one trumpeting Bavarian pine cone about his opinion. You see how this happens both ways? Perhaps that's why A.A. Milne's estate was so discourteous. Okay, so he hated that. Can we do more? Yeah, we can do more while we're moving. While we're going to 10 minutes that we have left on... Oh, my name is Frank Cotola. Man's name is doing the title of the show. The show is Cotola Chronicles. That's me. Breakfast at Tiffany's. This is a good one, too, because here is Audrey Hepburn's iconic role as Holly Golightly in the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's is arguably the only reason Hepburn is famous, according to this. Arguably, see? Maybe comes from New York. Even if you've never seen the film, you've seen the image of Hepburn in a pearl necklace with a black cigarette holder staring earnestly out at you from countless dorm room walls and shoulder bags, okay? I guess so. However, not everybody was happy with Hepburn's casting, and by everybody, we mean the author, Truman Capote. The novelist who wrote the book. Capote was so outraged by the presence of Hepburn that he said the studio had, and I quote, double-crossed him in every conceivable way using her, putting her in the film. Apparently, the novel's original title was Under No Circumstance Will You Make This Into a Movie Starring Audrey Hepburn. He's trying to be funny, the author of the article. Okay. Although Capote described Hepburn as one of his favorite people, he'd written the book with a specific actress in mind. You ready? Marilyn Monroe. Furthermore, Capote had every expectation of playing the male lead opposite Marilyn Monroe, despite the fact that he had never acted before. Capote wanted Breakfast at Tiffany's to be a film about Marilyn Monroe being romanced by one of the most famous gay men in human history. The fact that Capote felt personally betrayed by the casting of Hepburn was so well known that Hepburn felt uncomfortable whenever Truman Capote was on the set of the movie. Even after Hepburn's death, disappointments he had ever suffered was her presence in the movie. And he said this, quote, "It was the most miscast film I've ever seen. It made me want to throw up," unquote. Not even her tragic death softened his rage. Truman Capote, I think I've told you many times on the show when we talked about the name, I can't think of, Jack Kerouac. Thank you. The doors were crickling there. They ran to the files for that. Jack Kerouac, of course, one of the early beat writers, if not the early beat writer, the earliest beat writer. His famous book, On the Road, which Truman Capote read, and when On the Road was becoming a hit, Truman Capote said, this is how he criticized it. He said, "That's not writing. That's typing." It's one of my favorite little stories. Not that I have many about Truman Capote, I don't. Here's another one hated by the author, Das Boot. Das Boot, it may surprise you to learn the classic German anti-war film, Das Boot, is not about a boot at all, but a submarine. The critically acclaimed adaptation of Lothar Gunther Buchheim's novel launched the international career of writer-director Wolfgang Petersen, who we have just heard about from the other movie, Charlotte's Web, I believe, who he would go on to make other movies. Oh, and he made The Neverending Story. Okay. Also, audiences and critics alike have praised Das Boot for its sobering portrayal of war, but Buckheim disagreed. He insisted that Peterson's adaptation of his novel was a cheap, shallow American action flick. Let me tell you, it was a cheap action American piece of crap. Now I'm trying to smell gas. I wonder if there's a gas leak somewhere. I don't know. Okay. Well, we don't have much time. We're not going to get to all of them. Here's what Robert Ebert, remember Roger Ebert said, "I hated this movie." Hated? This is a quote from Roger Ebert. Listen to this. "I hated this movie. Hated. Hated this movie. Hated it. Hated every simpering, stupid, vacant, audience-insulting moment of it. Hated the sensibility that thought anyone would like it. Hated the implied insult to the audience by its belief that anyone would be entertained by it." Roger Ebert. Wow, that's definitely thumbs down, I'd say. 1994. Okay, so Buckheim's first-hand experience aboard U-boat operations, the film is simply too unrealistic. He said Peterson had injected too much tension, action, and emotion into what should have been a boring and relatively routine series of events handled by seasoned professionals. In other words, Peterson had made an exciting movie, but Buckheim did not want it that way. We move on to the very famous, and I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, if not a month ago or what have you, the movie Saving Mr. Banks is a movie about the lady who wrote Mary Poppins and how she was hating their, she's working with them, with Mr. Disney to make it into a movie. And of course, it's changed. And what's great about it, as I mentioned too, I believe it, is the psychological spin. It's not a spin. It's the psychological information about why she wrote Mary Poppins and the character itself. But Mary Poppins, a classic Disney film that paired Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke, with a bunch of animated penguins, among other things, almost didn't get made because P.L. Travers, the author of the Mary Poppins series of novels, really didn't want Disney or his schlocky commercial nonsense anywhere near her stories. So this is a very personal thing to her. It was not this happy-go-lucky lady with an umbrella running around helping. And of course, as was recently dramatized in the film Saving Mr. Banks, Disney eventually won her over, and the rest is movie history. I wonder what Disney would have thought of Tom Hanks adapting his role of his human being. And that's true too, right? That stuff goes on. As it turns out, the version of events included a few inaccuracies that, not in the least, which are the fact that Travers was never happy with Walt Disney. They just didn't like, go see that movie. That'll take care of that one. Travers hated the Marianne, and made it Andrews. They hated Andrews, and just the way the other one hated Hepburn. And Dick Van Dyke is a chimney sweep. Didn't work very well for these people. This thing, okay. Are there more? Is that seven, or is there more? You can go watch by Netflix wherever you get it. Saving. Oh, that's it. Because now it's a six happy ending. Oh, no, there's another one here. Six happy endings and accidentally screwed the movie's hero. They have all these lists now on the internet. Have you noticed that? Have you seen them? Well, you can go look for them anyway in any possible way, shape, or form. So as you see, adapting, you got to be careful how you adapt anything. The way you tell a story to somebody. You don't have to be a writer. The way you... Anyway, read books. Read the books. And if anything, this shows you that this proves that the book... Hey, what happened to that? Where's... Uh-oh. Oh. It proves that the book, a book, any book, okay, is so different that you can enjoy both the movie and the book. And if it becomes a t-shirt, wear the t-shirt and think about the book and the movie and can market the whole thing. Anything you do. Look at that. My timing is a little off there, so we'll just hit this now. Yeah. How'd that happen? Look at two clocks. I don't understand how clocks, digital clocks, can be different. I'm confused. My name is Frank Atoma. Man in the name of joins the title of the show. We could have talked about this, and we will bring it up again in other contexts as time goes by. But always check the source. That's the key here. Always check the source of anything. If it's a song, if it's a, you know, and you say, why? Well, then don't, okay? I'm just telling you what would be fascinating to you. Read books. Read. My name is Frank Atoma. Man, his name is the title of the show. We'll be back again when we can. It will be the 16th of October. Should we be safe and sound, we will be back with Cthulhu Chronicles. In the meantime, support all the stations who run this show on other, in other formats. Yes, and go to all their sites and everything in SRN. Thank you. Go to 148.ca /Frank and all the other stuff and listen
to us again. Good night, Mrs. Ernstweil, wherever you are. Now, what is that? What's this Ernstweil thing? He says every night and ends with R, wherever you are, when it should be wherever you look, when it's incorrect English that he's always telling us, huh? Well, get licensed to skill, you'll find out. I will see you, hear you, whatever. I'll be back. You're always in my thoughts. But right now, I have nothing more to say.